this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
World of Warfare, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holley, Ricardo on the board. S&P Futures up $1.75. NASDAQ Futures up $4.75. We're waiting for the PPI number today and CPI tomorrow. This month it's this order. Last month it was the other order. I don't know which... what the order is supposed to be, but sometimes one is in front of the other and sometimes not. Maybe Carl knows the answer to that one. Carl, how are you, buddy?
Oh, I'm doing all right.
What's the good word?
Well, I think what's the bad word is really the question, right? I mean, of course, the Bureau of Lies and Scams is always good for some side-splitting laughter when it comes to some of their numbers.
But,
I mean, you know, the thing that always surprises me is that now everyone ties themselves in knots trying to come up with an excuse. Okay, and the latest one that I just saw in the financial media, which is literally good for peals of laughter, is that now all the pundits are upset that OER is making inflation sticky.
OER.
Owner's equivalent rent.
Yeah.
We don't actually measure house prices in the inflation numbers. We measure this thing called owner's equivalent rent, which is what your house would cost to rent if you were renting it. And of course, you didn't rent it. You bought it. Okay. The other thing, and that has for the last three decades, literally, resulted in a depression of the inflation numbers. Okay, so which by the way, besides the propaganda value, which is substantial, that also screws everybody on Social Security.
Okay. Correct, but I'm sure they think that those people must already own their place, which isn't true.
Well, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The fact is that's where the data comes from that goes into your COLA change, right? So it screws the people that are on fixed incomes, and this is a systematic screwing. It's an intentional screwing. They know full well that it is understated inflation for 30 years, and they don't care. But now,
well, they do care. They wouldn't do it.
Well, of course they care. They care and they like it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So. But when rates were going down, I was pointing out that the general slope of the curve to the negative meant that this was inherently always going to hose you in that it would understate the inflation numbers. And this is it's just a mathematics thing, okay? It has nothing to do with, you know, I don't know if they intended it that way or not, but that's what it did. And they certainly didn't mind it because they didn't fix it, right? So now all of a sudden there's this screech owl thing going on about the fact that, well, it's going the other way because the curve is going the other direction. And I said, well, yeah, that's a mathematics. That's the way it works. Okay, leverage works for you, and it also works against you in exactly the same amount. It's just the other direction. And oh, by the way, this isn't going away anytime soon because we reached the natural limit of that directional change in interest rates, and now they're going to go the other direction for a long period of time. And even if they were to stop going the other direction, just stay where they are, you would not get the benefit in those numbers that you used to get because that's not happening anymore. And but now it actually is getting loud about this being, oh, we have to fix this. Excuse me, are you going to give me back all of what you stole by understating it for all these, for the last three decades? I doubt it. So yeah, that's the, the one side of it. The other thing that I think is so, it's uproariously funny, really, for people that are younger, they don't comprehend that borrowing money at 6 or 7% is actually a really good price when you want to borrow the money for 30 years.
Well, especially if the inflation is higher than that, or almost that high or higher.
Well, but I mean, even if inflation is 2%, it's an entirely fair price.
Yeah.
Okay. Time has value. It's the one commodity you could never get back.
It means you're paying 4, which is maybe a little higher than the risk-free rate, and you're getting 2% is the money, the inflation you're getting. So
it's the actual VIG, right?
As you started out into the detail on this stuff, I've come across, and critique me on this, please. It seems to me there's three ways they can gum these numbers up. I guess make that 4. Know what they're doing with the hospitalization numbers. The insurance numbers. But it seems like when you look at the medical stuff, the lie, for lack of a better term, there is they say it's 6% of the basket, and it's really 20 or 21.
Right. So it's 20-ish.
So if you do that going forward, you're not. If you were legit, even in the medical expenses were up last year 10%, you're not giving them anywhere near the weight that they should get. So you can lie kind of forever on that one, I think. If you don't get called out on it, the other one,
right? Pretty much.
Yeah. The other one is, you can just delay, like on the rent, or when during the COVID stuff, we had a couple years where who are the guys that give all the rent? Who's the company that does all the rent stuff? They were saying rent was up like 11%, and the rent on the CPI was up like 3. Okay, now, well, something like that. But if that happens, I think you can get away with it for a while. But as long as your waiting is proper, eventually that's going to work its way through, I think. Because at some point, if it's a year from now and it's double, I think you sort of have to catch up. I mean, it's harder to do than just saying, because I've got rent here. Rent to shelter is 35% of somebody's basket.
Right.
Okay, so that one, I think they are in a trick bag right now, Carl, because that one's a delayer. But if next year the rent doesn't go up at all, I think that thing's still going to percolate through. It's kind of a delay type of thing. I mean, they can just plain fed out lie on that. But then what'd they do with the health insurance? They said they tried to figure out how many retained earnings companies had it or some BS.
Yeah, this was one of the things that just, so their thing with health insurance, and this is, I don't know if this was always there, okay?
No, this is recent.
Yeah, well,
the part about figuring out how much money the companies are making and backing into it that way.
Well, I get that the explanation's recent, but what I've dug around and haven't survived, hasn't survived my attempted investigation. I haven't come up with an answer to the question. In other words, was this always there in some form? But until it produced absolutely ridiculously stupid outcomes. Did nobody notice? Okay, and then all of a sudden, when it came up with negative 30% inflation rate,
yeah.
People said what? but essentially, their argument is that the actual spend on medical care is in the data in another place. Okay, and so it's, for example, it's in medical care commodities, right? and it's in medical care services, and that's the actual amount of money that goes into people's, you know, that comes out of your pocket, so to speak. And so therefore the reason for that is the insurance side is essentially the VIG on the health insurance that gets sucked out of the economy, because if you pay a premium and then you get a benefit, then part of that VIG gets returned back to you. Okay. You buy homeowners insurance, right? And you don't have a fire. Well, that's an expense. That money's all gone. But somebody has a fire. Okay. So that's the technical explanation of why they did what they did. My problem with the entire premise is that when you look at the parasitic losses that are in the economy from so many of these different things, and healthcare is probably the biggest one that screws people all the time. But it's not the only one. Okay, there's a bunch of them. And when you take all of those parasitic losses within the economy, and again, it comes back to my argument that thermodynamics actually applies to absolutely everything, including economics, which makes people's eyes roll in the back of their head. The problem with this is that you can get to the point where I only really keep 20%, 25% of the effort I make. The rest of it gets... And the government does not, the government does not create value. The government distributes value.
Or redistributes.
Well, it distributes it.
Yeah.
It takes it from one person and gives it to someone else. That's distribution, okay? So that's what governments at all levels do. And some amount of it is a necessary thing. I mean, you probably like the fact that your toilet flushes and, you know, you can drink the water that comes out of the tap. As long as you
not don't... Not a bad thing, because what if it doesn't? You got a problem?
Well, yeah. I mean, so there's, you know, and the government-granted monopoly on power distribution is arguably reasonable, simply because otherwise you'd actually pay more money. Okay? So, I mean, there's places where it makes some sense.
But there's no... I guess my... wacky background, Carl. Someplace, somewhere, which you don't seem to, or maybe you don't want to get, not you personally, but is you have to do some kind of a review on all this crap. I would say so. It's like, I seem to recall when I was very young, when they put through a bill, wasn't there like a 2 or 3 year thing where they'd go back and look at it and see if it was working? Didn't they say, there was a name for that, where they would go back and review like a big spending bill or anything?
Well, there's all sorts of... See, part of the problem is that there's all sorts of requirements in laws that get passed that all this data be compiled and then turned back into Congress and therefore published, because anything that goes in front of Congress is a public record. One of the poster children for people getting away with this was when Reagan signed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which is why a childhood vaccine, anything on the childhood schedule, has a liability shield for the manufacturer. That came out of a fiasco with the DTP shots. There was a bad batch of them that was made. They injured a substantial number of kids and killed more than a few. And the parents, of course, were rightly outraged about this and sued. The response of the industry was to state that if Congress did not give them immunity from said lawsuits and stop this, that they were going to stop making vaccines completely. Okay, so basically they blackmailed Congress. And rather than say, okay, you can pull that crap. However, number one, if you do it, you're not going to get any more money. Medicare at this time did exist, so they could have done that. And secondly... no, you're not getting the immunity. People can sue you if you go out of business too dang bad. And if you don't want to make this stuff, we'll go ahead, we'll pay laboratories to make it as the government. All right, but no, they didn't do that. So they did this. But one of the things that was in that law was that annually, the data on injuries from these shots has to be compiled and present across everybody that gets them. Okay, so this is an actual data keeping, record keeping, and reporting requirement that's in the law. In order to get this immunity, this was the quid pro quo for it. It has to be presented to Congress. Do you know that this is 1986 was when Reagan signed this bill? There has not been one report filed with Congress. Not one.
What would Rosanna Dana say? Never mind.
Yeah. So, I mean, are these things actual? You know, is the safety record as is claimed? Well, nobody. Well, obviously, someone knows because the data does exist. But it has never been compiled, it has never been presented to Congress, and therefore the public has absolutely no idea whether or not these people have been lying through their teeth. And this now has been going on for what, 40 years?
Well, I think some of the stuff is not... I don't begin to be able to go from hospital to hospital and try and figure out what procedures are last year versus this year, because it's a zero-sum game. But what I did do on a Saturday that was... snowing, I didn't feel like shoveling, was I did a review. I'll say it's a somewhat sloppy, half-assed review that you can critique on three things that I thought were totally misguided in the CPI. And I looked at health insurance at the time, you know, because I know what PTI was going up every year, right? So I somehow found a spot on the internet. Now, of course, you know, who knows how rigorous it was, but the cost that firms pay for health insurance for individuals. Now, I think I'm actually cheating to the government side here, because as time went by and it got more expensive, a lot of times the deductibles got higher and higher. So if anything, I'm shorting this thing. But I think it was from 2000 to 2020 was when I did this. It was either that or 2007. Whatever it was, the government's view of inflation was 81%. Something like that. So almost double. So anything was a buck is now a buck 80. So I dug through the insurance payments that firms pay, the average, and it came out to 285, not 80. Okay, so the next thing I jumped onto was the cost of higher education, and there's a...
Oh, yeah.
Well, and then there's a site that is absolutely spectacular. Now, either can't find it or I think you got to pay for it, but it's every single school in this country, college, no matter what it is, junior college, you name it, all the way back to like either 1990 or 2000, will give you the rate every year for in-state, out-of-state, and the room and board, and it's absolutely spectacular. I mean, there isn't a tiny little school somewhere that these guys don't have. And
oh, that's cool.
Oh yeah, and then of course I went there a few times, and I think you got to pay for it now. Might be the board, the education department, or somebody has it, but it came out to, guess what, 285. Same number.
Yeah, funny that, huh?
Well, then I said, okay, now how do I get a feel for primary education, primary and secondary? I said, okay, well, this is going to be really sloppy and half-assed, but let's assume that your taxes, property taxes in most areas, especially Illinois, are somewhere between, I'm going to say, 45 and 55% of the bill is the schools.
Is that
kind of the number?
Yeah.
So I basically looked at taxes, and I wasn't about to go through every state, so I just picked Illinois, which probably is a little jaded, but guess what? 285.
Yeah, and it's funny.
Exact same number for all three things.
Right. So basically the bottom line is that they all came out in the same place, and that tends to be a pretty good validation that you're not full of it, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, once in a while from a listener, and I have some stuff I'm kind of cleaning up, well, listener, I'll get a list of where somebody will do a study. What's that thing that you sent around? Was it you or what's his name? Lou. Somebody sent one around where another inflation study for the last 20 years, and it's totally different than this one. But if you look at the price of the price of a house in 2000 was what? I'm going to say 150, something like that, 160. Now it's 400. I mean, we're not even on the same page as this 0.81 number. So this was a list of, like, all the stuff, a pickup truck, a house, you know, you name it. It's not even on the same planet as what the CPI is. And there's like, no look back. You know, and you say, wait a minute, how can you guys have this at 0.8? And now they got the crap going. Now, granted, there's some stuff that people used to spend in 2000. You spent a lot for your phone, right? You spent a hell of a lot more for your TV. You buy a TV once a decade, unless you're, you know, whatever, unless you're Mr. TV. But so I mean, yeah, there's stuff that has come dramatically down. I mean, cell phone bills used to be what, $200-$300 a month for people using mine, maybe more.
I mean, you don't have that. I think one of the things that we are, you know, that's rather obvious when you start digging through some of this data, it just jumps out at you, and that is that all of the things that the government has stuck its fist in to make more equal or better for people, it doesn't matter what it is. So I'll just list a few. Housing of various sorts, health insurance and healthcare generally, education, especially post-secondary education. All those things have skyrocketed in cost. And yet all those things that the government has more or less kept their fingers out of, i.e. cell phone service, televisions, computers, all those things have gone down dramatically in price. Well, you would expect, as productivity improves, as human innovation improves, that the cost of goods and services would decrease in constant dollar terms. Why? Because that's the whole definition of productivity: better, faster, cheaper. Okay, I mean,
as you get more productive, generally, the people there that are working at the place should get paid more, and the place makes a little more, but the price goes down a little bit. That's the way it ought to be.
Right,
everybody gets their little piece.
Well, and it's. I mean, we know this data. We have this data, the productivity data and stuff. Typically, it's about a 2-3% per year improvement, somewhere in the 2-3% area. Okay, and if you think about that, that means that if we had what we should have, if we didn't have firms and especially governments that love inflation, we should have approximately 2% deflation in prices per year in an open market. That would be the...
Well, if you're holding your money supply constant, which nobody
Well, not constant, on a per capita basis.
Right, on a per capita basis.
Right. I mean, because
if your economy grows 3%, your money supply should grow 3%.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that we actually, you know, despite all the screaming about this and that and the other thing, we actually see about a 1% increase in the non-institutional population on an annualized basis, and that's a fairly consistent statistic. Which you wouldn't think so, because, you know, there have been times that we've had crazy amounts of illegal immigration, like now, and then there have been times that we haven't. And yet the data doesn't really change all that much. And it seems to me that there are people inside the organs of government that either enforce or don't. Because I could, if you made me president, God forbid, I could stop...
I move to impeach.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It would take about 15 minutes before the articles got filed, right? And that's just because they'd have to walk them over to wherever the office was. But I could stop illegal immigration in essentially 5 minutes, and all I'd have to do is use an existing laws. I don't have to pass any new laws. I enforce 8 U.S.C. 1324 against both employers and all who harbor and assist, which mandates hard prison time, 10-year sentences, okay? Not fines. You're going to jail, buddy, and that would be the end of it. Because the first time that Joe Roofing Contractor or whatever, or Joe Golf Course Owner got hauled off and thrown to jail for real, 10 years in the can is a big deal.
Would that mean you'd have to take every single member of some real high-end golf course and they'd all be in jail?
What it would mean is that you'd only have to jail one or two of them and all those people would be gone. Because that's the thing about it, is that... No, you don't have to jail everybody. It's the same thing with the healthcare scams.
How do you pick two and they're all involved? You got to do them all.
Right now they pick none, which is selective prosecution. That's illegal too. So no, you can't. you can't make the argument that, well, you know, you jailed Joe over here, but you didn't jail this other guy, and so that's not going to fly, all right? That's not a defense. You know, it's like saying, well, we don't catch everybody that steals cars. Well, it's true, you don't. That doesn't mean that you're not going to jail if you steal a car. But if you did that just a few times, all right, and you made clear that you're serious, you're going to keep doing it, it wasn't a show, all those people would be canned instantly. And there's already, you know, this is interesting. I don't think I've brought this up. There is in Tennessee, we just passed a law, and all of a sudden there's this panic among all the illegal immigrants that are working illegally in the state. And I've had this reported to me by several people that own businesses that are in the sectors that, you know, traditionally use this kind of labor, right? And I couldn't figure out what the devil it was, because I went through all the legislation. I keep a pretty good idea of what's going on in the state with regards to the laws. I couldn't figure out why.
Carl, we have to continue this on Friday, bud. We're
what did we pass?
Well, Ricardo, take a note, bud. Let's also talk about the government's role in this, because back when it was, when a lot of the restaurants that I used to go to had people that maybe didn't know if they were legit. They were here and they were working, so they're legit people. Had Social Security cards that were kind of fake, but they sent the money in and it never came back. So the government was sort of involved in this. I read once, and this can't be true, but I read once that how many people had the numbers, all zeros across their Social Security number or something. Could that even remotely to and people send checks in? I mean, none of these guys, Social Security is coming out of their check, and they never were going to get Social Security. I mean, you're ripping these guys off on top of it, the government.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. They love it, and they actually have a second account under
their number. All right, let's push it to Friday. We're piling into poor Joel here. Take care of yourself. Talk to you on Friday. SP Futures down, or unchanged. NASDAQ Futures down 15. Home Depot's earnings were out, and Home Depot is it's up $2, even though they missed on income and something else. We'll go over with those, but Joel will be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Ricardo on the board. SP Futures up 50 cents. NASDAQ Futures down 13. Nothing much going on. I say in the Dow, we've got Goldman Sachs up 350. We got Home Depot now up $2, even though they kind of missed on some stuff. We'll talk about that with Joel and Kenny. Over in Europe, we have the DAX down 33.2%, FTSE up 5, call that flat. CAC around down 5, call that flat. So they're all waiting too. We think it's inflating data, we don't know, but they're just waiting. Nikkei up 176.5%, Hang Seng down 41.2%, Shanghai down 2, call that flat. There's nothing much going on over there. Yesterday, sort of an inside day. Dow was down 81, S&P down 1, NASDAQ up 47. Bonds unchanged, 4.81. The Bund up 1, 2.53.
Japan up 2.96. They're looking like they're getting a 1%. Wow, that'd be something. Oil down 22 cents, 78.90. It keeps hanging here in the high 70s. Brent down 22 cents, 83.14. Natural gas down 3 cents, 2.34. RBOB down 2 cents, 2.49. We've got gold down a little bit yesterday, is up a little bit today, up 6.40. Silver's up 16 cents to 28.61. Copper up 9 cents because it continues to creep. 4.86. This is probably one of the most consistent movers to the upside here in a while. For just about anything else, I wish I had some. FX, the dollar is pretty much the same, 1.108 against the euro, and 1.26 against the British pound. Has been moving much lately. Crypto, Bitcoin down $1,200, 61,800. Carter, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Kind of cold and cloudy today.
Morning, Chief. You're absolutely right. It's currently 6:34 a.m. right here in beautiful Chicago. Looking kind of gloomy, though. We have, not the best weather. 54 degrees Fahrenheit right now with a high of 56. Areas of morning fog, mostly cloudy, breezy, and cooler with a touch of rain. And tonight will be cloudy and breezy with a shower in places this evening, clearing late with a low of 50 degrees. On to Phoenix. Phoenix, Arizona, 74 degrees right now with a high of 98 degrees. Partly sunny and hot, and tonight will be clear with a low of 71 degrees. On a traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, we got 16 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 38 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 26 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 15 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is going to be 27 minutes. On the sports, only got the MLB this time. Major League Baseball, Cubs lose to the Braves 2-0 in Atlanta. The Diamondbacks beat the Reds 6-5 in Arizona. And the Nationals versus the White Sox, this game was postponed. It was supposed to be yesterday, but it was postponed until today at 6:40 p.m. in Chicago. The Reds and Diamondbacks also play at the Chase Field in Arizona today at 8:40 p.m. And the Cubs play the Braves again today at the Truist Park at 6:20 p.m. And that's all I got for you, Chief.
Do we have Joel?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, good morning.
Joel, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good. Just waiting on the PPI data at 8:30.
Can you be one of the wise sages that tells me why 1 month the CPI is before the PPI, and next month it's the other way?
I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. I don't know what the Fed's cooking up for us. Maybe that's just the way the computer spits them out, but... CPI is still the primary number, setting a high bar, low bar, but it's just the way it's the way they're doing it. There's no rhyme or reason for the explanation.
What do you make of these Home Depot earnings? Good, bad?
Home Depot, I mean, I saw that it wasn't the greatest report. I'm just looking at the price action, and it's up a couple bucks. So, there wasn't a real high bar going into the report, which, hasn't fully participated in the April rally. I still look at this $350 area that's been capping it since the early April. Still looks good. Trading range from 330 to 350 and kind of just below the lower end of the trading range. Bad month last month, trying to work its way back. So, I mean, you could go to the recession talk, interest rates, going lower, whatever you want to, attribute the earnings reports to. But so far, not a bad reaction in the pre-market trading.
No, I've been doing a little more construction lately. We had some stuff we left over from last year, and I've been there, Home Depot, a few times in the last few weeks, and I don't know how you carve out the inflation numbers from the comparable sales are down 2.8% in the first quarter as compared to last year, right? So I got to believe that. I mean, it's real hard because if you go in there, some of the stuff, you can get things on sale and so forth. It's not so bad, but God help you if you buy anything that you need with something. Like I bought a little tub of tile, a glue, and it was $55. I went back 3-4 years ago. What I was paying for that, I don't think it was that. So I mean, it's not the headline stuff. It's all the little stuff you need to make to complete the job. It's weird.
You doing that stuff yourself, Chief?
Oh no, I got guys. I do the designing and the running. I used to, but that ship has sailed. We're not doing ladders anymore.
No, I mean, the outlook is, it's okay. They didn't blow away. You don't like to see the comparable sales and overall comparable sales down, especially in the U.S. Coming up on retail earnings seasons, I mean, this is not a great report. But then again, the reaction in the price action is not all that bad. So Walmart got some big ones, Target coming up. I think we'll get a better look at the retail sector. We'll see if there is any follow through here on, people spending a little bit less money because things are more expensive.
Well, for the first time, last week was a interesting week for the earnings because everything blew through the straddle by like seemingly two times, but this is very muted. The straddle leg was $14. I was looking at it last night or somewhere in there, and it's moved $2. What do you make of this GameStop blowing up again yesterday?
What do I make of it? If you are an active trader or an active investor and you have strategies for trading these kind of things, then go at it. If it's something you just hopping into and have it as a quick rich scheme, well, it's working so far. Just sell it on the way up and be careful buying it on the way down. We've seen this story before, right? And we know what happens eventually, but eventually could be a long time. We know how long it persisted last time. I will say, though, with regard, I'm not going to make any specific comments in GameStop because I don't go to the stores, but Lisa and I did go to a movie on Friday, and we wanted to see, The Fall Guy. And there weren't that many people in our actual theater, but there's other theaters there, but the parking lot was pretty busy. I don't know. They must have been seeing the other movies. And Lisa's like, why don't people do this more? Why don't people get out? It was fun. It was a good movie. So there's your fundamental outlook on AMC. Lisa had a good time at the movies on Friday. Does that parlay into 136% increase in the price today? I don't think so. I have no positions in either of those stocks, long or short. Nor will I be taking any positions in those stocks.
The question I have is, how much of it do you think is? I mean, clearly, the stock hasn't changed in the last 2 days in terms of income, or any kind of predictions. But how much of it is just? This is a hard question. That's why I ask you. How much of it is the market fabric is? You and I dance around this topic a lot. The market fabric is a little screwed up. There's no standing orders. Once something starts to move, everybody just gets out of the way. Anybody who's a market maker, it could trade 500 mm-hmm. before anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's different than the way the market used to be with one specialist spot and with orders on either side and those kinds of things. I don't know how much different, or I'm not just saying I want to go back to Mayberry, but the fact is, when something like this happens, it's some sort of momentum trade, and you've got, I think, the people who are essentially making markets in it, as soon as they see it happen, they just get out of the way. Why would you be in the way? I mean,
well, there are people short, and actually, yeah. I have a very specific answer for you, Chief. This is not a new phenomenon, right?
No.
Pre-market trading, right? But what's been added over the last couple months is, I believe, Interactive Brokers and Robinhood are allowing 24-hour trading. And so, it used to be that equities were caught, shut off at 8 p.m. and reopened at 4 a.m., but that's not the case anymore. And so there are markets out there that are being traded, and there's some very, just don't think it's just, the apes. There's some very sophisticated people trading this off the paper, trading this by algorithms. So it's just a phenomena, and free markets for free men, right? That's what they used to say, or free markets for free people. So if there's going to be markets overnight in these stocks, that people have every right to be going out there and buying and selling. And if there's a preponderance of buyers, then the price is going to go up. Preponderance of sellers, the price is going to go down. once again, this is something that's been going on in the stock indexes since 1992, with the stocks not being open, you know, the true liquidity. But, you know, it's a different picture at 9:30. And I hope a lot of people that hodled are getting their money back, and they're, you know, using this price action to, shore up whatever they had in their portfolio. If you want to look at the all-time highs for everyone to get their money back, right now the all-time high split-adjusted in GME is 120.75. And the all-time high reverse split adjusted. What do you think the all-time high in AMC is, Chief? Just take a guess. Reverse split adjusted. What do you think the all-time high?
Well, didn't the company find a way to sell Treasury stock at like 30 or 40 or 50 and made a bunch of dough on that? And they actually were able to survive COVID because they were able to sell into it or something?
They did financial engineering. They did a lot of different things. They jammed a lot of. I mean, they tried the ape stock. I don't even know if that's still around anymore. They tried different things. No, ape's not even around anymore. AMC, the all-time high is $642.65. Wow. So. A lot of people are getting their money back. Still ways to go to the all-time highs.
From 11 to 600? Yeah, a little ways.
Yeah. Hey, in this market, Chief, in this market, when the companies report earnings, you know, it won't matter again. But we've seen this picture before, and I just hope that, that people are using their funds wisely in this kind of price action.
Everybody just convinced they missed out yesterday and should have been in. And,
And your buddy's getting rich and everyone on Twitter's getting rich off it. Unfortunately, but there's halts. I think that's the biggest thing. I think the most important thing in all my years of being involved is protecting my capital, right? And if I go out and buy 1,000 shares of GME right now at $74, yeah, well, maybe I'll be able to sell it at 79, 80, or 100. But what if it drops in that, you get right now the halts are not affecting it. But what if it drops $5 during the regular session and it halts on the reopen? So protect your capital. And if you're good at doing that and good at trading these markets to protect your capital, then you're not going to get any wilder than this kind of price action.
Oh, yeah. What? It's crazy. Joel, talk at you next week, buddy.
Okay, go blue.
SP Futures up a buck. Nancy, are we going to go straight to Kenny, or you want to do a quick break, Ricardo? Ricardo?
Kenny's on the air. He should be.
Oh, Kenny, you with us?
I'm here.
This whole idea of this stuff going on, on the one hand, by the way, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay, just this, I can't believe these meme stops are coming back here, but they are, and this market fabric, and on the one hand, you want everybody to be free, which you want it, but you also want an orderly market, Kenny. And an orderly market, to me, who traded in the OEX for 20 years, and I think to this day, it was the single best stock or best index or anything that ever traded for the public. The reason for that is 60 or 65% of all the trades were public to public,
right.
which now is at what, 1% public to public?
Right.
So the idea of somebody getting a deal at 3 in the morning, it's not happening. I mean, some hand, you want something orderly. You like people to be free to sell their houses, but you also want them to be free in some kind of a system where the prices are listed and people can see it. You want some... I don't know where we go with this. If this happens during the day, that's fine, but every offer is getting pulled in this thing, right? And I'm looking at... GME is up another $47. We started what yesterday at $12. Now it's $77.
Yeah. This guy showed up again, Frisky Kitty or Roaring Kitty, whatever his name is. He shows up over the weekend after being silent for 3 years, and it just all of a sudden creates this excitement as if something's happening again. And all these meme traders, they jump right in. Once again, this is not a space I played in. I'm not trading meme stocks. It makes no difference. It's up 70%. Okay, great. Knock yourself out. I just think the whole thing, once again, is just a big bubble. I don't know what this kid said yesterday. I wasn't following it. All I know is that, he's sending these cryptic comments. Okay, whatever. But listen, you can argue with it. The stock had a 77% move. So if you bought it in the morning, you made good money. If you were short it, you were going to get clobbered. And so I think you just have to be careful.
Well, I think you do too. I just wonder when there's, why are you open when there's nobody there? I mean,
yeah.
Plus, these companies, the one yesterday, and I'm not going to make any kind of recommendation, but I was reading some stuff that GameStop has no chance of profit, or very few profits. I mean, I didn't go through this stuff, so don't trade on my account or anything. Why do people, there's stocks I wouldn't mind shorting. I have some puts and some stuff and things like that. But the idea of just sitting short on a stock day after day, month after month, week after week, when it looks to me like it's already down pretty low, what's the game in that? Why can't you have any calls to cover your upside? I mean, what are you doing? You're kind of waiting for something like this to happen to you.
Well, either that or, I guess if you're just sitting on it short, you're really waiting for it to completely implode and go to zero, which would be that would make sense. But I hope you protected yourself on the upside after what happened 3 years ago. You saw how these guys got absolutely destroyed.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I think they said something like $1.5 billion worth of shorts got absolutely clobbered yesterday between these meme stocks, And I looked at, in my note this morning, I put in that index. It's UBXXHSHRT, which shows you the most shorted stocks out there. It's got a list of names, and you saw, GME and AMC, and I think the other one was BlackBerry, up huge. And then there were a bunch of, there's probably another 80 names that also got dragged along. They're not necessarily meme stocks, but they're the highly shorted stocks. And yesterday, all those stocks got taken higher just on the back of all this excitement. Again, I never played in it 3 years ago when it first started. I thought the whole thing was way overblown. It ended up being overblown. People trying to justify buying GameStop at 500 because it was going to the moon. Yeah, how'd that work out? It went back to zero, basically.
Yeah.
And now this kid started again, right? This frisky kitty started again with cryptic comments and so driving the place crazy. So I just stay away from it. It's not an area that I play in.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you know this, Kenny. I've told the story in the air before, but I don't know if I, what's the show that's 4 o'clock in the afternoon on CNBC here? It's Fast Money.
Oh, Fast Money. Yeah. I think it's at 5. But yeah, the options trade.
No, in the Midwest, it's 4.
It's 4. To me, it's 5. Yeah, right.
Well, that show actually was, sort of Dr. J's show. I don't know if you know this.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yep.
And Dylan Radden and I was John and me. Two other guys. One guy was his dad was a Merck, owned a Merck clearing firm, and the other dude was this investor, crazy stuff, kind of big, tall, good-looking guy, Armenian dude. His family was in the construction business, absolutely drop-dead gorgeous wife, and he somehow got the family money and everything, and he was absolutely convinced. I think the stock was, might have been Tenet Healthcare, and he was shorting the hell out of this thing because he somehow read or found out. I don't know why. I didn't really dig into it because I didn't want to know because I didn't want to give the information out to people. It had something to do with there was something wrong. Somebody was cooking the books or the chairman was doing something. I don't know. Something untoward, right? Yet the stock is a huge company, and it kept going up, going up, going up. And this guy was shorting this thing, and I think he blew through all his cash, all the family's cash, everybody's cash, got carried out basically. And it couldn't have been 2 months later. Whatever he thought was true actually was true. This stock went from like 60 to 6 or some story. It was a long time ago. I don't remember the actual numbers, but turns out he was right. But it's timing and protection. You got to be careful. I mean, it's stuff when you're doing these things. Because the guy, he was right. But you can be, what do they say? The market can be irrational long after you're out of dough or something like that.
Yeah. You can be. What's that called? You can be. It's legendary.
I know. I just stumbled on it. It's some famous line about you. The market can can be wrong. Long after you're out of money or something. Something like that.
Yeah. I gotta look it up because it's like a famous quote. The market can be irrational longer than you can be solvent.
Something along those lines. And it sort of happens. Like these, but this whole idea that you jam the short interest. But I don't I seem to recall, Kenny, when I first started way back, that didn't they used to do the earnings things like in the day when somewhere like at 10 o'clock they'd close, yeah. They'd stop a stock for 20 minutes and they'd give the earnings.
They would halt the stock, yeah. Right? They would halt the stock because it was during the trading day.
Yes.
So during the trading day when they come out with news like that, they typically would halt the stock, they'd put the earnings out, they'd let the market kind of digest it, and then they'd reopen it. Right?
Yep.
So listen, that famous saying is exactly that. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent.
Well, one thing I will say, Kenny, is that if I was a chairman of one of these companies,
yep.
I would, if I could possibly could, I would beg, borrow, and steal the money to have some treasury stock so I can let some stock out at this price.
Yeah.
For those that don't know what I'm talking about, if you have new stock, you can't just go out and sell it. You have to go through a full issue. But if it's already been in the market and you buy it back, it's now a treasury stock. It's issued, but it's back to you. That's what's called treasury stock. And I think you're free to sell that whenever you want, aren't you?
I think you are, although, you know, the regulations have changed so much, but I think you are. I think you can sell treasury stock, no problem.
I mean, there's some times during the day you can do it. There are probably those kind of restrictions. It can't be opening or close. I mean,
Nobody
used to have all that stuff. But by and large, I mean, if you bought some game stock in at $12 and it's trading 70, yeah. I think you could leak some out and have the world's best IPO this morning if you want to.
Yes, but you know, I think you're right. But the truth is, I'd have to look.
Yeah, me too. It's changed things.
I know for sure you can't do it. You know, half an hour after the opening or half an hour before the close. I think you have to let that time frame go by.
Because didn't AMC was almost belly up, weren't they? And they were able to sell some stock so high that they actually made it through COVID.
Yeah, I think it was AMC that did that.
But you know, it's funny. You and I being in the business, all we're sitting there going, "Yo, be careful." Last night, I had a adult beverage with my usual group on Monday nights after everybody hits the gym. Everybody, there's like five people. Everybody was like kind of in a different spot, a different gym or someplace. They all come in and they go, "All we're talking about is where can we buy some of this stuff." it's the momentum world. It's not you're in my world anymore. Everybody, even the guys who are in the locker room attendant says, "The one guy, hey, should I buy some of this?"
yeah, that's like, you know, when the taxi drivers start talking about how they trade their account, you know, that's the top of the market.
Yeah.
Right? In New York, you always say when you get in the car and the taxi driver's bragging about how much money he made trading the market, you're okay, that's a top time.
Yeah. It is interesting. You just wonder where the valuation is. And I have a feeling, you know, that if we only traded from 9 to 3 like we used to, that somehow or another the price discovery was better. Because I think the market ought to be, in my opinion, this is an old guy talking, ought to be really customer to customer, and the other people should be there just to take the momentary. What does a specialist or market maker do? They don't really make prices. They handle imbalances in supply and demand momentarily. They don't make the prices. I mean, the public makes the prices in the right world. But I think right now, last night, if somebody wanted to buy this stuff or somebody had to, and all of a sudden somebody got a short, there's nobody there. Okay, how much you want to pay? 40. Okay, we're at 45. All right, I'll pay 45. Well, then I'm at 50. That's no market.
No, that's no market. But when you say you pay 45, don't forget, before you can pay 50, you have to go through the system and clear out any offers that are between 45, 46, 47, 48, up to 49, up to 50, because you can't trade it from 45 to 50 in New York without clearing out all the other markets, right, that are connected electronically that you can't see. So you have to put bids into all these places that take it up to 50. You got to take everyone at their price. You can't sweep the market anymore the way you used to be able to.
Well, the
right.
But how many standing orders do those other places have? None.
Well. It depends. Sometimes in those dark pools, people don't want to be in the lit market, so they're hanging out in the dark pools. So, you don't know until you go there to find out.
Well, the other problem is if you're going to pay 50 and somebody's sitting in one of these dark pools at 46, you get taken out at 46.
But now, that's right.
In the New York Stock Exchange, you'd have got 50.
Well, but that's the whole point, which is why the dark pools exist. So people that don't want to expose themselves in a lit market hang out in those dark pools. So if I try to buy stock up to 50, I'm going to run into this guy at 46. I have no idea what he's got, how much he's got, how aggressive he's going to be. All I know is that I tried to buy, you know, whatever it is, 20,000 shares, and I bought, bang, suddenly I bought him at 46, and I go, oh boy, there's a seller around, right? 50 wasn't the right price. There's a seller at 46.
Or you could say, or you could say, who is this chump? The price is now 50, and I just got him from him at 46.
Well, you could, but it depends. If the guy's sitting there with a half a million for sale at 46, you're not going to trade it at 50,
right?
Because it's not going to. It won't get there until you clear the guy at 46.
What is your sense of standing orders in these dark pools? I had a feeling that they never really were any. There was exchanges for people to go and get in front of the market.
There aren't a lot of standing orders. There aren't a lot of stocks with standing orders in the dark pools. The days that there are is days that there's news out, and you get these institutions that want to make, they want to buy stock at a certain price, or they just want to sell it at a certain price. And what they'll do is they'll spread their orders out across a range of exchanges. So they'll send some to a broker in New York. They'll put some into, you know, across a range of dark pools, and they'll just sit at 46. The problem is, in New York, if I walked into the crowd and you were standing there and you said you're selling 46, I said, tell me what you got, because I'm a buyer. You and I would have a conversation. Suddenly you say, I can offer 50,000 to 46. I'd say, take them, and I'd buy them. But in a dark pool, I can't have a conversation. So I don't know if the guy's got 50,000, 150,000. All I know is that if I want to go in there and try to buy stock, I can put in a 46 bid for 50,000. And if it's there, it's going to trade. I'm going to go, oh, shit, this guy has at least 50. Maybe he's got more. I don't know. So that's where that's where the darkness comes in, right? Because you can't have a conversation.
Well, I think it's kind of messed up. You know my opinion on that. I think yours is the same. You having a good week, buddy? What's the weather? You guys, no hurricanes, nothing? You're good down there?
No, but we're coming into hurricane season in June, so we're not that far away. But right now, the weather has been perfect. It's actually been beautiful.
Great.
And so today's another gorgeous day. I'm just on my way down to the beach to record my video with the ocean in the background. Because
wait a minute, you do the video in your bathing suit?
No, you know something? Maybe I should.
Okay.
No, my wife would kill me if I did that. Oh, my God, she'd kill me. No, I'm not doing it in my bathing.
Your thong? Oh, God. I don't want to go. Were you doing it in front of your yacht?
Yeah, but no, I'm doing it right on Juneau Beach with the beach in the background, with the ocean, with the sun rising. It's actually beautiful.
We're not going to say that Ken's been successful, but he's doing this in front of the Queen Mary. This is his boat, you know, type of thing.
I'll see you next week.
See you next week. SP Futures unchanged. NASDAQ Futures down 13. We're half hour away from our PPI number. We'll be right back. Professor Helsner.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Well, don't pay Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Cardo on the board. SP Futures are up 50 cents. NASDAQ Futures down 9. Again, we have PPI today, CPI tomorrow, which is a different order than last month. CPI obviously is a bigger number, but if you look at the PPI, if you dig through it, which not a whole lot of people do, and I'm that Mr. Dig in the PPI, but if you look in there and you see there's the services sector, and then there's the goods sector, and the goods sector is considered by a lot to be a predecessor of future CPI. The other one, the services sector, maybe not so much. I don't know. Professor Hell, is there considered a big lead-in between the services part of the PPI and the CPI, maybe. I don't know. What do you think on that?
I'm not sure if there is one. I do know that I'm not sure if this is true, but I saw it on Twitter last night that coffee's up 75%, and the BLS took the coffee component out of the CPI. And I joked about it that the only thing that'll be left in the market basket will be VHS tape recorder players, landline telephones, and what was the other thing? I said there will be three things left in the basket by the time October rolls around.
Yeah, it's I think they're kind of caught with their own. By the way, I was just reading this thing. Sorry, I'll change subjects real quick. I was just talking to Kenny about like AMC is up a bunch today, and then GME is way up, and they're I said, you know, if I was in this deal where these meme stocks blow up and I knew people were shorting my stock, I'd probably try and find a way to have some treasury stock around just in case it were to blow up, I could sell some, right?
Yeah.
Well, here, get a load of this. On Monday, AMC Entertainment raised $250 million in new capital, and they sold 72.5 million shares at an at-the-market equity offering. They sold these shares at an average price of $3.45 before commissions and fees. Stock's now trading $9.50. Nice sale, guys. God. I mean, it's not funny. Nice sale. I guess you could have. But now this was an offering, though, so it probably wasn't treasury stock. And I don't know the rules on that. I used to know them a little bit. But the bottom line is you have stock that's been authorized but and issued. You have stock that's authorized but not yet issued. And you've got treasury stock, which is stock that has been issued, it's been in the market, and you might have dragged it back in for, you purchased it for stock options for your clients or whatever else it could be. But it's stock that's already been out there that you bought back that I think, with some restrictions, Carl, you can get back out there if you want to. You can't just issue new stuff without some kind of an offering, correct? I mean, again, these laws change all the time, and it's been a while since I went through this stuff. But anyway, that's the bottom line. But it seems like if you catch some people short and you start trading in off hours and there's nobody else around to even sell it to you, you can drive stuff around these days. It's kind of I don't know if I like those markets, but they're not axing me, Carl. They're not axing me, Carl. Yeah, you know. Anyway, you and I have been going back and forth on the NIL stuff and what's going on with the college sports and everything. But I think one thing we absolutely agree on is that there's going to be how many PhD papers on how this all plies out, you know, and how you.
Well, there's probably dissertations in the workings right now.
Yeah, I mean it's what we're talking about, the college football, and this is kind of where Hal and I have a slight disagreement. College sports, they always, your deal was you got a scholarship, okay, and then obviously the high end players always got a little something extra from some, not always, but very, very few guys, okay, got some stuff. But if the rules were so harsh that stuff like, well, you had to wear a sport coat, but they couldn't give you money for a sport coat. I mean, it was really weird. I mean, when Notre Dame got in trouble, one of the assistant coaches gave one of the guys like $50 for a Greyhound ticket to go home. This is years and years ago. For a Greyhound ticket to go home for his uncle's funeral or something. Oh, no, you can't do that. Okay, fine. I mean, I guess I can't. But so it was all this little, I'd say, piss-ass little stuff, right, that people used to get nailed on when, yeah, everybody kind of knew that if you know, the guys who were really good might have a car a little better than everybody else, but it wasn't like some brand-new car or anything. So I'd say that an incredible amount of the people that were under scholarship at places, you might have 10 or 15 people that had somebody getting some help, or you got some help from tutors. I mean, there was extra stuff, but there never was really a bidding war between schools, I don't think. And that's what's all of a sudden become interesting now, is that, plus, nobody wanted to transfer because you couldn't play as a freshman. All right, so now if you're a sophomore and you decided to leave, you had to sit out your junior year. And if you're studying, no, I really don't want to be in school 5 years. I'm here for four. You know, I got to get a job or something. It was, you're right. There was always a little something going on. Yeah, but the difference between now you're getting paid by outside parties, and they're raising money that some people think is tax deductible, because what you're doing is paying the kid to go talk in a hospital. So you're gonna try and say that's a charity, even though you and I think that's probably BS. I mean, there's all kinds of crap happening where now you're not getting paid by the person who actually is, quote, employing you. They're still denying that you're an employee. And when you have stuff like workman's comp, it's all unclear where that's going. I think the thing is so wide open here. And I, you know, whenever I have a adult beverage with somebody, I always argue the point. I mean, obviously the solution to some is why doesn't the school just pay them to get these other people out of the mess? And yet, this is another issue I have that I can't really drop on too many people. They don't really, as much as we sports fans think, you know, football is the only reason why there is a Notre Dame or a UCLA or a Southern Cal, it's just not true. It's just not true. I mean, UCLA's budget is $11 billion. I mean, they got a football team and people like the football team, but really? I mean, a football team could drop in the ocean and the place wouldn't miss a day, you know, in terms of the hospitals and this. The place is massive. And I'm not so sure if you and I are on that board, Hal, where we want those people to be employees, where 20 years from now we get 15 lawsuits for the mental stuff and they all want $40 million apiece. Do we really want to be in that business? I mean, there's no union like the professional unions, which, in my opinion, very stupidly essentially said, give us more money, and by the way, don't worry about the people who have the mental problem. Just here's a settlement, and that's it. Well, that's fine. I don't know where unions got the power to negotiate away medical problems, but evidently they think they do. But that's not happening in college. I mean, this thing is just a massive subject. I mean, I think you and I can agree on that. And you and I are watching it from an economic side, going, holy bleep, this is like the deregulation of airlines and trucking. This is something in the economics spectrum that comes around once in a lifetime to study, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened is you have this organization called the NCAA, who for years used amateurism to deny the players. I mean, if a football player is an employee at the professional level, what is that person at the collegiate level? If their labor results in all this income to an organization, I don't see how you can't consider them an employee. But the NCAA, you know, they hid behind this word amateurism for decades to deny these players compensation. And players that wanted the compensation, who were not very satisfied with a scholarship, room and board, they were probably able to get some compensation that was probably considered illegal by the NCAA. In my opinion, denying those players their compensation was a crime.
Well, and there was
NCAA is a massive cartel.
Okay, well, there's two levels there. Okay, one is, and you know this, one is they went so far as to say they owned your name, image, and likeness, hence the name NIL. So, yeah. And Dr. J's brother, Paul, who unfortunately died of a Lou Gehrig's disease, real nice guy. When he was at Berkeley, he was the same. He was at Berkeley. He was an other linebacker from Rivera, was it Ron Rivera, the head coach forever. So they were best buddies. Anyway, he's a good-looking guy. He wanted to be an actor, and somebody offered him a summer job, to something like like Kohl's or someplace, to model like flannel shirts. He's a good-looking guy. Wasn't going to be wearing his Cal Bear hat or anything. And they said, "Oh no, you can't do that. We own that." Well, that was foolish. But everybody looks at sports today, and you see this massive amount of money. When I was in school, it wasn't like that. Colleges played probably a 10-game schedule, so it means you got 5 home games. There weren't very many bowls. The Irish didn't play in a bowl from, I'm going to say, the Rose Bowl in the 20s to 1970. They just thought that's not what you should do. I mean, people are going to school, they're going to class, they got finals, they shouldn't be running around the country playing football. I mean, the difference is, and I'm going to say maybe your high-end quarterbacks or somebody deserved a little more than the tuition fees But out of all the people on scholarship and all the different sports, probably 5% were, quote, underpaid. I mean, it was enough. It was an extracurricular activity. You didn't show up. Those guys showed up to practice a week or two before the rest of the students. You went home, got a summer job like everybody else. Granted, was there some competition for a guy like Paul Hornung coming out of Kentucky? Probably. You know, that type of thing. But still, it wasn't. You lived in the dorm. I mean, I don't know. I mean, some places they didn't. But pretty much they lived in the dorm. I mean, it was. You're right. There were a few pennies around someplace, probably. But nothing like this. But as the money grew, matter of fact, I think, Hal, the limit the NCAA had on salaries for assistant coaches was like $60,000 not that long ago. Yeah. But then all of a sudden, you know, you could only be on, I think, two games a year on ABC. So the Irish were always on with the Southern Cal game was always on. And I'm having one other game was on. That was it. So there was none of this massive sports, you know, TV money where all of a sudden, you know, and there wasn't all this, well, they were always betting on it, but nothing. It wasn't until, I'm going to say, 20 years ago to where the numbers got so big where coaches are making millions of dollars and buyouts, and so you sit there and go, wait a minute, what about the players? This is getting crazy. So, I mean, yes, you're right, you know, like, you know, original sin was always there, but it wasn't Sodom and Gomorrah. Can I put it that way?
Well, you know, I don't know if I agree with that because...
I know you don't, but so go ahead. I know you don't.
The Pac-12, which didn't get the Pac name until, like, the 1960s, it went through... I mean, when sports broadcasters talk about the decline of the Pac-12, the collapse of the Pac-12, they make it sound like it was set in stone for, like, 120 years. It wasn't. It was a very fluid thing. At one time, Idaho and Montana were in what was considered the Pac-12, but it went by a completely different name. At one point, it was the Big Six, the Big Five. So this idea of conferences being these set things, set in stone things for decades is complete hogwash. And ESPN knows better. But what was to become the Pac-12 included, I think, about six teams in the 1950s, and it disbanded because four of the universities were embroiled in this pay-to-play scheme. So they had to disband the conference. It comes back a year later with basically the same teams, just with a different name. USC, I think, was famous for
pay-to-play. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I'm saying when you start talking about the Pac-12, they led the league in cheating. I mean,
you have the Southwest Conference, and you probably have the Big Eight. Yeah, and does anybody think that SMU was alone back when they were in what were they in the Southwest Conference?
Yeah,
yeah. Do you think they were alone?
No,
doing what they were doing? Probably not.
But conferences were way worse. I mean, Chuck Muncy had a house on the beach, right? And O.J. Simpson never graduated any place, and he started. I'm saying he might have graduated high school, and he went to San Francisco.
He went to community college for a little while, and then he went to USC.
Then he went to USC, and he was running track before he never graduated there. He never graduated USC. Yeah. But was he getting more in tuition? I'm going to say probably, but the Midwest was not. There was. I knew some guys that were really good high school players that maybe went to Michigan, or a couple went to Notre Dame. There was never. I mean, I would have heard Michigan's paying me 25, and the Irish only want to pay 20, so I'm going to Michigan. I never heard anything like that.
Yeah,
and I don't know of anybody who lived on the beach either. You know, so I mean,
maybe for kids from the Midwest that were going to these schools, maybe tuition and room and board was a sufficient compensation. But maybe in LA, you know, with
it wasn't. Holiday, maybe not. Yeah,
maybe not. Right.
Yeah. I remember what your favorite the Tark, Jerry Tarkanian.
Yeah,
remember him? He was UCLA had this, you know, the incredible basketball team. And the NCAA is always coming against UNLV because they got good enough to where they were like challenging them, right?
Yeah.
Remember his wife, the big man, the curvy blonde with the massive hair. She had big hair back in the day.
I don't remember.
She was a piece of work, and she goes something about why are they always coming after us? We just played UCLA, and our guys are wearing letter jackets, and their guys are wearing fur coats. So yeah, I mean to say that it. It didn't, but you know, my cousin went to, he went, get a load of this. He went to Tilden Tech here in Chicago. He's a freshman. He gets out there. He tries out for the football team. So many kids were in Tilden Tech that he, you know, I don't know how many people went out for the freshman football team, like 250 or something. So they just did like some wind sprints, and they were cutting guys off the wind sprints. They said, all right, your guys are cut. So somehow my cousin was screwing around, so they ended up cutting him in the wind sprint. And so my uncle, who played 12 years at professional ball, not NFL, but you know all the other leagues that were going on at the same time, he knows the coach, of course, he knows everybody, goes to school, and he says, hey, what'd you cut that guy for? He's the fastest kid in the neighborhood. He goes, well, he didn't look like it. He goes, give him another chance. So they send an assistant coach to his class and say, be at practice tonight. Well, next Saturday he's starting at halfback, right? But he ends up going to University of Colorado because they wanted the quarterback. The quarterback evidently was a big star. So he'd never even seen the place. But the idea of a campus visit. You know, he goes out there on the train. As soon as he gets there, the quarterback gets a call from, like, Nebraska, says, I'm going to Nebraska. I got, like, a better deal. Come on, let's go. My cousin goes, what are you talking about? I just got here. I can't tell my mother I'm going to another school already. So he stayed. He ended up playing for Nebraska for 4 years and went to a bowl. And he had, you know, a guy, I guess, that took care of him a little bit. But still, he was in the ROTC. He ended up with an ROTC scholarship on his own, became a pilot, and was in the Air Force for 5 years afterward. I mean, you're right. Was there something there? Probably. But, I mean, the guy had to work during school. You know, I mean, that's not happening to these guys today.
Well, I think what's going on today is you got all the social media. You got ESPN covering these kids 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You got Fox Sports. So, I mean, just the media has changed a lot. You got the internet. You got Twitter. You got Facebook, Instagram. They're you know, if you have personality and you're an athlete and it looks like you're going to be a number one draft choice, I mean, there's just all kinds of opportunities you can exploit off that personality of yours and your athleticism. Maybe in the 1970s, it was just different, right? Maybe a car was enough. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the best sports movies of all time that I think of, it's one of my all-time favorites. It's about a basketball player from Colorado, and he gets recruited to go play for, you know, UCLA, but they can't call it UCLA, right? And John Wooden. And it's called One-on-One with Robbie Benson. It's just really, and it just shows how, you know, you give this kid a car, and then you basically treat them like a subhuman for their 4 years,
yeah.
Right? And when this kid got a chance to play in his freshman year, I think it was, when he got a chance to finally play, he lit it up. And the coach that was keeping him down, keeping him grounded, I guess, maybe, if you will, but, you know, just brutalizing the kid. He walked into the coach's office at the end of the movie and said something to the effect of, now that everybody's seen me, I can go anywhere I want. I don't need you, right?
Yeah.
And I think that movie is just, it really, in my opinion, shows just how brutal this whole system was.
Oh, it's terrible. The guys
the who rights of these kids.
Kevin says the Pac-12 schools were cheating pikers compared to the old Southwest Conference.
Probably. I mean,
well, I mean, Darrell Rowe was
Wild West, right? That's the culture.
Well, Darrell Rowe was he got the idea that if you made people go for 5 years, the guy in Nebraska is the same way. If you abused them enough and they left, you could recruit more people the next year, because some guys don't grow, some guys don't develop. I mean, it's a But
and they can be—they're a big kid at 18, but they're the same kid when they're 22, right?
I'm just kind of stunned at the when it's all said and done, I don't know how many schools are being involved in this. Everybody's convinced that their school is going to be. I don't know that everybody has a budget for 15, 20 people constantly working this waiver wire, for lack of a better term, and giving bids and offers. I mean, it's so far away from being, quote, a university. I mean, maybe Alabama, maybe even Notre Dame, the football's so ingrained, but I don't know if Northwestern wants to do it. I don't know if Indiana wants to do it.
Yeah, I don't think Northwestern is going to be in the Big Ten very long. I don't think Vanderbilt's going to be in the SEC very long. I think it's going to end up being like the 25 teams that want to do well kind of in the northern areas in the Big Ten, and 25 teams or so that, you know, want to take it to the next level in the SEC. And the schools like Vanderbilt and Stanford and Northwestern, I don't really see them being in this this mix.
Well, I think the contract's going to change too. If you steal somebody from somewhere, you're going to have to pay them.
Yeah. Well, just what the Big Ten and SEC are doing in terms of, hey, if we don't get 68% or whatever of the CFP, we're gonna create our own CFP. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're colluding. I mean, in the United States, it's against the law for organizations like the SEC, like the Big Ten, to engage in the collusion that they're doing, and nobody seems to care about that. So,
what percentage of the population has any idea what you just said?
Probably not. Yeah, I mean, they're just flat out colluding, right? The NCAA's been a collusive organization since its beginning, right?
Well, little at home story, and I've said this before. When I was on the board of the CBOE and a member, which I was for a long, long time, the chairman, this guy named Duke Chapman, nice guy. His dad was the head of CCB for a while, and was ended up getting a government job. He went to Fordham, played ball there, and so forth. But the idea of him calling the president of the Peacoast or the Philadelphia Stock Exchange or Options Exchange and just chatting about what can we do together would never happen.
Yeah.
Would never happen. You couldn't make that call.
No. Uh-uh.
I mean, and
yeah, they're doing it right there out in the open.
Yeah, I mean, that's why once in a great while there'd be a SEC sponsored event where you could go and actually maybe talk to the other guy or something. But you can't. Yeah. You couldn't just call up and say, how about we get together and like raise prices? You couldn't do that. Nobody even knows that you're not supposed to do that stuff now. But everybody, what do you mean? The guy from Home Depot can't call a competitor and say, how about if we buy you guys for this and give you $1 billion, we take you over and raise prices? I mean, now you can do. You can get away with that all the time. Nobody even knows it's a law.
Yeah, the analogy I use for college football is the Soviet Union. You had all these controls in place, right? And you still have these black markets. Black markets are just markets trying to free themselves of all these rules and regulations. The NCAA was basically the Soviet Union. It determined who was going to be on TV, determined basically who they're going to prosecute and who they're not going to prosecute. It's very selective, right? They had favorites in basketball. They had favorites in football.
But you also had only three channels.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Soviet Union collapses. NCAA basically collapsed. I mean, the NCAA is a collapsed organization with respect
to football.
Yeah. So it's a collapsed organization with respect to football. And what has happened, right? The same kind of stuff that happened in the industries of the former Soviet republics and Russia, the same kind of stuff is happening in college football, right? It's just this, it looks from the outside as complete chaos, but What's trying to happen is a market that was prevented from working for over 100 years trying to figure out
That's one school of thought, and by the way, I absolutely understand your point of view and maybe share it. But the other side of it is, hey, look, we're a bunch of colleges. We got people that want to play football. We can sell a few tickets. It's a nice thing to do on a Saturday. Blah blah blah, and. Why don't we get something together and decide what the rules are going to be that we all play by the same rules? Nobody ever really wants to play by the same rules, but
I think that might have been it.
But I'm saying that those people, once those people decided we don't want to play by any kind of rules, we don't need them, we're going to do whatever we can to screw the other guy, all of a sudden you're not. I mean, when I used to play softball, you know, in Mount Greenwood and all these parks I played in, the teams got together. Okay, we're going to use these umpires. These are the rules, the bases. You can use steel spikes, not use steel spikes. I mean, you went through a list of stuff you did, and everybody decided this is what we're going to do, and you paid, you know, an extra some money for the umpires and to keep the fields together. If we all just said, we don't want any rules, we don't want to do crap, we're always going to show up on a Saturday and we're going to have knives on the bottom of our shoes, okay, then we can go do that. But I mean,
I think rules for the particular game itself, that's one thing. But you know, college football is big time business. You know, billions of dollars.
Well, it is. I'm saying it is now. It's evolved to that. But when it first started, these guys are going to be students. We're going to have, you know, maybe one bowl game and blah blah blah. You can't show up for practice. All these kids need to work in the summer, so you can't be here all summer unless they're going to summer school. You know, you can only start practice a week before Labor Day. You know, all that kind of stuff. So we're all sort of even because this is just an extracurricular activity.
Yeah, but even within those rules, schools tend to get around them somehow by delaying the start of their semesters or delaying the start of the spring semester. I remember when Oregon played Ohio State during the Rose Bowl. Oregon semester started during the week of the championship game. Ohio State's did not. Ohio State
could
practice all day long. Oregon couldn't.
Well, I mean, I get it. The point is the schools came together to say, this is what we're going to do. And by the way,
they discovered there was money there, right?
Well, I mean, it used to be you couldn't start basketball practice. Was it November 1st? It was a day in November. So the big thing at South Bend was that night, the first practice that was open to all the students was at midnight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
right. So I guess we're cheating by having it at midnight. But it's not the same as the next year saying, screw you guys, there's a tournament over in Hawaii. We're all going, I mean, it's different than starting a practice at midnight.
I think what happened is they discovered there's money there, and a few people are greedy, and they're gonna control this organization that sets the rules, and they're gonna engage in selective enforcement of the rules.
They didn't
be able to compensate, and some aren't gonna be able to compensate.
The selective enforcement came later when the money became bigger. But yeah. I think
SMU was one of the sacrificial lambs, right?
They decided that they wanted to be big like the other guys.
Yeah.
Once you do that, you got a problem.
Right?
But I'm going to say, I guarantee
Oklahoma and Nebraska had money going into them too.
But I'm saying that I thought the Big Ten in the 60s, 70s, the point is, are we going to be on TV with three channels twice a year for all of us, or are we going to try and get all the money we can and form a new station, which you couldn't even do in those days, and try and all spin out of the group? But once the money's there and everybody spins out of the group, you get, which is what you have now. You have chaos, in my opinion.
Well, just the federal government limiting the number of channels, just that alone.
Well, they didn't limit it in those days. There weren't any.
Well, but they were regulating who could create a channel, right? If it was a market,
but there wasn't UHF technology wasn't even there. There was no cable.
Yeah.
There was no satellite.
People could have maybe popped up, channels, and maybe cable TV would have came quicker than it did, right?
We
don't get to observe that world, right?
Well, when I first came up, they couldn't find anybody. Now all of a sudden we got 20 stations, we have no content.
Yeah.
Which is now, they're willing to pay sports anything for the content, right? Because there's no content. And people love the sport. Now you put the gambling and you hope that people are going to watch games they don't care about just because they can gamble on it. But if that falls apart, I don't know where this money is going to come from anyway.
But I guarantee you there was money. There was demand for games on television during the 1980s. I turned the TV on, like, none of these teams are in my region. I want to watch this game. I had to watch a game that was between Maryland and Florida, right? I had no interest in that game, right?
Well, but who's going to put on, I guess you can put on the Oregon State game at 9 o'clock at night. You get somebody watching it. But SP Futures down 15, NASDAQ Futures down. These numbers, we'll be right back with the numbers, 0.5 versus 0.3. So we're going down, but not very much. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. but I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com, and it's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ricardo on the board. SP Futures down 11 as these wholesale prices came in at 0.5% more than expected. So the S&P futures down 11, the Nasdaq futures down 64, but not only down 57. So it doesn't look like they're too bad. Carter, while these other numbers fill in, why don't you grab the traffic, weather, sports?
Absolutely, Chief. Good morning. It's 7:34 a.m. right here in beautiful Chicago. Looking pretty gloomy today, though. 54 degrees Fahrenheit with a high of 56 and a low 50s today. Areas of morning fog, mostly cloudy, breezy, and cooler with a touch of rain. Tonight is going to be cloudy and breezy with a shower in places this evening, clearing late with a low of 50 degrees. On to Phoenix, we got 72 degrees right now with a high of 98 degrees Fahrenheit, partly sunny and hot, and tonight will be clear with a low of 71 degrees Fahrenheit. On the traffic in Chicago, we got inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 37 minutes, inbound Edens from Lane Cook is 63 minutes, inbound Eisenhower from Well 44 minutes, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th 31 minutes, and Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan. It's going to be 49 minutes. On to sports in the MLB. The Cubs lose to the Braves 2-0 in Atlanta. The Diamondbacks beat the Reds 6-5 in Arizona. And the game from the Nationals versus the White Sox was postponed until today at 6:40 p.m. in Chicago. Additionally, the Reds and the Diamondbacks play again at the Chase Field today in Arizona at 8:40 p.m. And the Cubs play the Braves today at the Truist Park at 6:20 p.m. And that is all I have for you right now, Chief.
Well, I've got the PPI for final demand 0.5% in April, services up 0.6, and goods advanced 0.4. So, some people think that the goods come through the into the CPI more than the services. I don't know that that's true necessarily. What might have already asked you, but what's your opinion on that?
Well, they're both pretty close together, and you know, we got to remember that. Inflation is not the change in the price of some service or the change in the price of some good. It's the excessive growth of the money supply. That's what inflation is. And the, you know, prices rising is just a symptom of the Fed or the central bank printing too much money. And the thing about inflation, when the inflation gets, when we've had an acceleration in the money supply for so long, and it was so incredible at first, 40% in a year and a half. What ends up happening is inflation tends to do what eventually? Well, if money is being devalued because the Federal Reserve is printing a bunch of it, whether they're doing it digitally or however they're doing it, literally printing it, it doesn't matter. What happens is people salaries can't keep up with it. And so what you're going to see is the luxury items, the wants, the demand for that is going to wane because the people are having a difficult time buying their needs. So that's probably what's going on the good side, right? People are cutting back on the excesses. You know, they're probably cutting back on the streaming services they're subscribing to. Maybe they're only subscribing to one or two of them instead of three or four of them. They're not buying the Starbucks coffee anymore. They're not going to the McDonald's anymore. They've been priced out of those things because the basic needs are so expensive. And so I think that's what you're seeing.
Well, what when we talked about, well, as you can imagine, when I was in grad school with those guys, the monetary theory guys, we talked about inflation all the time. Plus, there was inflation, right? It was, in the 70s. So the two things that they would constantly warn about is that, A, it's, if it was even, nobody'd care, but it's never even. Some people are impacted. Some places have concentration, and they can raise prices. Other people can't.
Yeah.
It's never even. The other is, once it gets going, the first little bit of it feels so good to some people that it's like your first beer, you know, and it's hard to stop.
It's heroin.
Yeah, those are the two things that they constantly warned about, and sure enough, here we are how many years later. I never thought we'd go through this again in my lifetime. After all, it's all I did when I came out of school is work with that. The thing that's somewhat odd here is that, I don't know if people believe the BS or what, but maybe it's because there's not as many unions. I mean, people think there are because they see the public employee unions, but the other unions are nowhere near as strong. So, as this happened, it probably started in 68, right, when they went off the gold standard? And kind of
Nixon had it. He signed the executive order, I think, in 71.
Okay,
Nixon is the one that signed the executive order that took us off the international gold standard.
That's right. Basically, we went off the gold standard to pay for the Vietnam War. We wanted to print money to pay for it, which is the same thing we did with the Afghanistan, same thing with Iraq, right? I mean, it's not like it's a new trick.
Or our current wars and
and whatever we want to call our stuff now, the never ending war on terror, because how can you ever stop being warring against terror? It's always terror, and you always got a war against it, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying that the nomenclature is it'll never stop. But the point being is they do that, but now it's reached this somewhat of a crescendo, but it's never even. I mean, you can't. But to finish my point, it went on so long that by the time I entered the picture in the late 70s, most of your unions that have had and virtually every contract of any size was written with an escalator clause in the contract. That, you know, I don't see that at all. I mean, I'm not in the businesses that much anymore, but I don't see that anywhere. Do you? I mean, maybe the auto workers, the people at Caterpillar, all these people that allegedly got these huge contracts, you know, 25% raise over 4 years. Well, first of all, I think they're 15% behind even with the 25. But we had, by the time I was involved at Pullman, the contract with the commuter cars from Boston that I was most involved with, the Amtrak contract, they basically had a full bore escalator in there. So if the contract was for $60 million, and if the first quarter inflation rate was 1%, I called the dude up in Boston and I said, "Hey, Joe, this is Tom Pullman. I got us at 1%. That means the price is now $60 million and whatever, $60,000, $600,000." And he goes, "Okay." and then I'd figure out, okay, the guys that in the, I don't think the unions were ever 100%. They were like 85. So okay, the guy in the desk next to me, our union guys would get a 8.85% raise that quarter, and the guy who sold us the trucks, which is the wheel and axle combination, he might have been 100%. The lighting guy might have been 80%, but you didn't want to be the guy that didn't have that in your contract. Because you got screwed. Because the prices were up in the 3 years it took to build those cars, the prices were up 35%.
Yeah, I don't know if that would work today. I mean, when I
it works if works for you if you got one.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying though is 1970s was a much different time. We were 20-30 years removed from World War II. I don't think a lot of the European nations had fully recovered from the devastation. Japan was barely recovered. We didn't have a South Korea. China was nowhere to be seen. I mean, so the United States is the only people selling lemonade on the street corner, right? We have no competition. And so I think it's easier to build that kind of automatic adjustment into these contracts. But when a company that's buying from you can buy from somebody else overseas, they might go, "Well, you know what? I understand it's up 1%, but we're going to get our stuff from this company over here now." So I think in today's landscape, it's really, I think our economy was more closed off back then, not because of trade law, just because a lot of the countries hadn't recovered from the World War, right? So nowadays, China's a player, India's a player, You got players all over the world, right?
Well, you do, but it still doesn't change the dynamic. I mean, we're talking about a from signing.
It's more open. There's more choices.
But I'm saying, harder
to raise those prices.
I know, but the stuff that I'm talking about, if you sign a contract, a 5-year contract for a road, you just signed it, okay? And the guys are going to have to buy concrete for 5 years. You can't say, here's the price, and have COVID happen, and the concrete is going to be 40% higher in 3 years and expect these guys to eat it. I mean, there's no way that Japan's going to... you're right in terms of widgets, but you're not right in terms of a contract of that magnitude. You can't say, okay...
Well, I'm pretty sure that, you know, in today's climate, you know, there's probably all kinds of outs in these contracts that... I just think there's probably a lot of outs because there's a lot of choices.
Well,
right?
There are, but once you sign it, there aren't. You know what I'm saying? Once you sign for a builder for a building, it's going to take you 5 years to build. The Chinese are not going to come in for 6 months and outbid you.
In the face of lots of different choices, I think the contracts that are going to be inked are going to be different than the contracts that were inked in the 1970s.
Well, okay.
Maybe weren't as many choices.
Let me turn my argument around. I'm arguing with the professor. We turn my argument around.
I'm just saying the contract structure.
Okay, but
going to negotiate, it's just going to be different than it was.
It might be, but you can't be an idiot. If Ricardo says to us, "You guys are pretty good builders. I'm going to develop this whole area over the next 5 years. And by the way, I want you guys to give me these specs on a house, and bid on the house." And we'll say, "Okay." Looks to me like it's going to cost us $200,000 for the house based on these prices. And by the way, how about we charge you $230,000? And the guy goes, done. Well, hell, you and I are the two dumbest bumpkins on earth if we don't say, wait a minute, there better be an escalation clause in this thing.
Yeah.
Because if we'd have signed that contract 5 years ago, I got news for you. Hal and Chief are living in a tent.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I also think those contracts with those escalation clauses can probably... cause a business that can't absorb those increases to go out of business. Too.
Well, okay, but why? How could you price something in 2020 that you're going to deliver to somebody today without an escalation clause? How could you even do that?
Well, I'm sure people try to do it, but I'm sure on the other end the buyers probably kind of pushing back on it.
Well, right? Sure they are. Sure they are.
They're pushing back on it because they probably feel the squeeze too, right?
Well, that's why they're negotiating. I'm saying that the point was, both the authorities and Pullman, the point was, we're not in charge of this escalation thing.
Yeah.
Okay? So neither one of us are the Fed or the government. We're just a ping pong ball going back and forth. And we're just saying we want to, the price today is here, we agree on. That price might not be there a year from now if these idiots run inflation up 15%.
Yeah.
Right. Neither one of us caused it.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. That's why the CPI number has to be accurate because people are using it or should be using it. I mean, right now, I mean, if you and I signed up in 2000 to deliver 10 houses a year for the next 20 years and we priced them off $150,000, are you and I still in business?
Well, you know, here's a great example in economics for professors, for example. You're a tenured professor at a university, and there's inflation. The university's squeezed, and they can only give you 1 or 2%, and that goes on for about 10 years. And your salary is not keeping up with the cost of goods.
Right.
Meanwhile, the new guys that are hired, they're hired at the market wage, right? So there's this complete inversion in salaries, right? So the new guys, they get hired at the new market wages that have been inflated. Through time, but the tenured people that have been there for 10 years, they're getting crushed, right? So even this kind of thing happens amongst PhD economists.
Well, right? if that's what I'm saying, that's why these numbers, first, the inflation shouldn't be allowed to happen in the first place, which I think we both agree on, and secondly, if it's going to happen, and nobody seems to know what it's going to be, where you have an inflation clause in a contract, be it a building, whatever it is, then it's incumbent on the government to at least give you a fair number, and don't cheat on the number because then they're killing you both ways.
I'm saying if
for instance you had as a tenured professor 10 years ago you sign up and you say, okay, By the way, Hal, we're gonna increase this by inflation every year. We're gonna give you 90% of the inflation. And you say, okay. And all of a sudden, 10 years later, the government tells you the inflation was 5% when you know it was 50%. You know, yeah. But then the new guys are getting a 50% more money than you because everybody knows it was there. Well, you're just being cheated one way or the other, right? I mean, that's when you got to say, "I'm out of here" because I need the market price instead of. But I mean, if the number would have been correct, you wouldn't be in that pickle, would you?
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing about economic depression is that, you know, they don't offer, at least not in my experience, they're not offering, you know, CPI plus, you know, an increase in your pay based on performance. They're just basically giving you something less than CPI.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And, you know, you kind of take it, and you kind of take it, and you kind of take it, and then all of a sudden, when this new guy's hired, and he's you know, just right out of graduate school, and he's making what you're making as an assistant, you're an associate, for a lot of people, they just kind of like, well, I mean, if I'm an average economics professor, I just stay here at the school, and you just kind of eat it. If you've got a lot of publications, publications are your currency, and maybe you can use that to get a position at a institution where you can get that market wage.
Well,
so it's just really, really complicated.
But that's why hell.
People get complacent and comfortable, and what ends up happening is the ones that are comfortable and complacent, I think they end up complaining, and then it pulls down the quality of education.
It's
really kind of messed up.
But you said it for I'll just pick a year, even though it's going to be a wrong year. Let's just say 2000, the turn of the century. I'm going to say that the mean person, you know, not lawyers maybe have kept up, hospitals have kept up even more probably. Regular people, there's no way in hell that their average salary is up 2.5 to 3 times to 3.5 times what it ought to be to keep up with inflation.
Yeah,
So every year that you get a 3% raise and inflation's really 5, you're really getting a cut in pay. And the population...
You are, exactly.
Yeah, the population has essentially put up with it for 25 years. And it's even so... You know, they always accuse old people of being politically active. I don't know of anything that put it in the old people's face more than you probably know this. But if somebody's on Social Security, when you get to 65, you can take the Social Security earlier if you want. Blah blah blah. I know a little bit about this, but I'm not a tax guy. But when you're 65, that's when you can get on Medicare, correct?
Yeah.
So your hospital piece is, quote, I'll use the term free, included, right? If you want the doctor's piece, it's a couple hundred dollars a month. Well, they take it right out of your Social Security, right? So they don't send you the check and expect you to send a check back. I mean, they're smart enough to not do that. So every year, you're paying, you know, $250. I think the number is now. Last time I saw somebody's tax return, $250 a month for your hospitalization, even though you have Medicare. Now, if you want the drugs, it's even more. And if you want an outside thing to cover, it's not covered. You can be paying $500 a month when allegedly the government's paying everything. They're not. But this year, somebody gave me their thing from Social Security. Talk about sticking it right up somebody's behind. Wow. The Social Security increase was it 3.3? Something like that. But the increase in the medical piece that you pay out of the check was like over 5. So talk about telling you right on a piece of paper how they're screwing you.
Yeah,
you know, I get it. The Social Security, they're having trouble paying it. Blah, blah. You know, I understand this whole bit, but they're basically telling you your raise is 3.5%. But by the way, the stuff you're kicking us, it's 5.5. I mean, it's right on a piece of paper. But
is inflation really 5%?
Well, the hospitalization sure is. I mean, it's way more than that. But my question for you on this is. When I was in school, the monetarist dudes and probably when you teach a class, okay, and you talk about monetary theory, if the Fed, for whatever reason, you know, normal times, whatever normal times were, if the Fed made somewhat of an adjustment, rightly or wrongly, that they were going to put more money in the system a little bit, say they put in, you know, $10 billion over a quarter because they whatever they needed, whatever the economy's slowing down, so maybe the The money supply contracted that way. Anyway, they put it in. It used to be that people would say it's 6 months, give or take, for that to work its way through the system. If you were to teach a class today, what number would you use? That's question number one. And the second number is, you sort of alluded to it earlier, when you put so much in, 40% in a year and a half or 2 years, what happens to that six-month number? Does it explode? Is it still 6 months? Is it still happening? I mean, I wonder if it's not still happening. I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. But I don't think it's 6 months anymore when the number's that big.
Well, you know, the thing about the model here, a lot of people think we're still in this old dynamic where if the Fed puts a bunch of money in, interest rates come down. They come down along the demand for reserves curve, right? And that's just not the case now, right? You put in $10 billion, the federal funds rate's not going to change. You put in $100 billion, the federal funds rate's not going to change.
Well, if there was federal funds, it would change.
Yeah. But
there aren't.
The interest rate's not going to change. The interest rate's going to be constant.
Okay, well, okay.
The interest on reserves.
All right, before you go on, I'm not trying to interrupt. Before you go on, let's define what the federal funds rate is, what ought to be. The federal funds rate...
Yeah.
Because the federal funds rate, every bank, if a big swinging dude like Hal took a $30 million check out of Northern Trust in one of his accounts and dumped it in, I'll use the term First National, everybody's got to have a cover on some of this stuff. So the Northern Trust probably is a hair short on reserves last night because Hal took his money out of there and put it over in, what did I say, Continental Bank, wherever the hell it was, put it over there. Now, Northern Trust needs to borrow a little reserve overnight. Continental, probably, because Hal's money is now over there, has some excess reserves. So they're going to say, hey, Joe over at Continental, how about lending me, you know, $20 million of reserve? And he'll say, fine. And there's a price for that.
Yeah.
It's called the federal funds rate. So yeah. What the Fed can do on any given day is pull money in and out of the system to where when that phone call gets made, man, there's not a whole lot of money in the system tonight. The rate's 2.5%. Or tomorrow, maybe the Fed puts some money in the system and they go, you got me on a good day, it's 2.48 or something. So in terms of the federal funds rate, the Fed can impact that immediately. But now, everybody gives the money back to the Fed. There's so much out there that I don't even know. Is there a Fed funds market? If there is, it wasn't like it used to be.
Well, the Fed's funds rate is the interest rate on reserves. So.
Well, but I'm saying it used to be the rate at which banks charge each other overnight for excess funds.
Yeah.
But now it's not. You're right. Now it's not.
The Fed could lower that by pumping a bunch of money into the system
right.
By treasuries from banks, right? So it could push money into it and pull that rate down.
But if they put a bunch of money in, somebody might say, wow, inflation's going up. The long-term rate might go up. So they can't control that one as like they can the overnight one.
But just only that interbank rate.
Right.
If they put a bunch of money into the system, you know, $1 trillion, then the federal funds rate would come down. But today, with interest on reserves serving as a price floor, kind of like the minimum wage, right? There's so many reserves in the banking system that when it dumps a bunch of money in there, it just stays there. So I would say that it takes a lot longer for you to fill it. It's going to be a lot longer than 6 months.
So I guess
I think for rich people who borrow at the prime rate, you know, the billionaires that borrow at prime rate to buy assets, leveraged assets, you know, they can get that, they can get access to it immediately. But I think it just takes so long for that to get to everybody else. So I would say it's much longer than it used to be.
Well, if you're in a credit card, it never gets to you.
Yeah.
Which is kind of scary.
Real
quick, we don't have much time. We mentioned last week, I think, I don't know who brought it up, was that might have been, I don't think it was Carl, might have been, I don't know who it was, but that these debt numbers, look at credit card debt and the other stuff, they're all almost turning upwards, you know, to the point where, you know, auto loans, those kinds of things, instead of some bumping up a little bit, a couple of them are kind of almost going like vertical, and we talked a little the other day about worldwide debt is what, $322 trillion if you look at everybody's state, local, federal, credit card, cars, mortgage. I mean, it's never anything being. Is that, if everybody owes everybody else, now is that a problem? I mean, if you're looking for another planet, they say, okay, they all owe each other. What's the difference? But I think it's some point it does make a difference, because the interest, if the interest can't get paid, then the face has to come down, right? Some sort of default.
Yeah, I think eventually people are going to run out of, I mean, if this debt keeps rising like it is, I mean, you look at the federal government, I mean, we were talking about whether it's adding $1 trillion every 100 days, you know, and there's some debate about that, but I mean, interest is over $1 trillion.
Yeah.
And if interest rates keep climbing, it's going to be $2 trillion. Eventually, those interest payments are going to be greater than our tax revenue. So that is not sustainable. And at the household level, eventually, you're not going to be able to pay the interest on your own debt. So it's going to, and it's all a result of all these nations throughout the world following this Keynesian idea that deficit spending is great, you know, to stimulate the economy. Because politicians, once they hear that you can stimulate an economy with debt, that's all they want to do.
Oh, yeah.
That's all they're going to ever do.
Hey, are you on Thursday? I think Lou's out of the country. He might want to trade, but would you maybe you could do a half hour Thursday morning, and we'll talk just about these debt numbers, because I mean, I'll get you some stuff, because guys, actually, you might already have it, but it's a pretty fascinating discovery, you know, and it's all about are we ever how quick is it growing? When you keep lying to yourself, it's a problem. If you say the economy is going to grow at 5% and debt's only growing at 2%, you feel like you're okay. But then if all of a sudden the economy only grows at 1%, you got a problem, right?
Yeah, when interest payments are more than your tax revenue, I think you have a bit of a problem.
God, S&P futures down 1%, NASDAQ futures down 33%. So we've walked our way through the bad PPI number. So we'll see tomorrow whether that number is any good. We'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.